From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Encore Week continues with my infamous encounter with Gene Simmons of the band Kiss. It's the interview that landed Simmons on Rolling Stone's list of the 10 biggest disappointments of the year and inspired Entertainment Weekly to name him Crackpot of the Year. Also, we hear from guitarist, singer, and songwriter Wayne Kramer. In the late 60s, his band the MC5 released the album Kick Out the Jams, and their music became the soundtrack for many political protests and demonstrations. The band is now considered one of the forerunners of punk rock. This year, Kramer had a solo CD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House is deploring the attack on a Baptist hospital in Yemen that left three American missionaries dead and one wounded. The head of the group that runs the facility says the killings will not deter Christian missionaries and medical workers from serving there.
Our personnel, as Americans and Christians, are well aware of the risk of living and serving in a place like Yemen. Yet their love for the Yemeni people and obedience to the conviction of God's leadership has been expressed in a willingness to take that risk and give of their lives.
Jerry Rankin is the president of the Southern Baptist Convention's International Mission Board. Authorities say a man described as an Islamic extremist opened fire after slipping into the building with a gun cradled in a blanket as if it were a baby. The FBI is searching for five men believed to have entered the country illegally last week and who may have information on terrorist activity. The agency has appealed for the public's help and posted the men's photos on its website. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
The men all appear of Middle Eastern descent. The FBI lists their names and dates of birth, but officials caution that's likely false information. The State Department says it has issued no visas in any of the names. The FBI believes the men entered by ground from Canada on or around Christmas Eve. The agency found out about the men while investigating a human smuggling operation that uses false passports. Officials stress they have no evidence the men themselves were involved in terror activity, only that they might have information on others who are. One report said investigators are focusing, among other places, on New York City. Security there is already heightened, as tens of thousands are expected to gather for New Year's Eve celebrations. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
Opponents of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez are threatening to step up their month-old general strike with more civil disobedience and a tax boycott. Phil Gunson reports that the government's opponents say they're on the verge of ousting Chavez.
And on the other hand, the government, of course, is saying all the time that things are on the point of getting back to normal. And it's a little difficult sometimes to weave your way through the conflicting reports from both sides. It's clear, whoever you listen to, that there's a serious crisis. And the difference really is whether the government actually has it under control or whether, in fact, things are going to remain at this critical level for some time.
Phil Gunson reporting from Caracas. The strikers are calling for an early vote to remove the president, but Chavez says the only constitutional referendum of that sort cannot come until August. Meanwhile, world oil prices continued to rise today, in part because the general strike in Venezuela has virtually cut off oil exports from the world's fifth largest producer. In stocks, the Dow gained 29 points to close at 83.32. The Nasdaq lost 8 points. This is NPR News. The Machinists Union at United Airlines says it will challenge the bankrupt airline's attempt to cut its members' pay by 13%. Most of the airline's other big unions have agreed to pay cuts designed to keep the air carrier in operation. Israeli troops killed three Palestinians in separate incidents today. The violence came as the Israeli High Court rejected a petition from Israeli reserve officers seeking an exemption from service in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
A Hamas fighter was killed after he crossed a Gaza security fence into Israel and engaged Israeli troops in a gun battle, according to the army. A Palestinian schoolteacher was shot and killed by troops after a road accident in the West Bank city of Nablus. His car reportedly nudged an army jeep, which tipped over. The man stopped and got out of his car and was shot and killed as he approached the troops. The army said the soldiers believed he carried a suspicious object, but his body was found unarmed. Also in Nablus, soldiers killed a 20-year-old Palestinian during a clash. The army said he was lighting a Molotov cocktail when he was shot. The Israeli High Court said it would not sanction the refusal by reserve soldiers to serve in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The soldiers had argued that the Israeli occupation is illegal. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
French police say they've arrested a baggage handler at a Paris airport after weapons and explosives were found in his car. The man, identified as a French citizen of Algerian origin, was arrested Saturday at Charles de Gaulle Airport. Police say they found a handgun, a machine gun, plastic explosives, and two detonators in the man's car. He reportedly told authorities that he carried the weapons because he feared that there was a plot against him at his workplace. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're calling the days between Christmas and New Year's Encore Week, and we're featuring our favorite music interviews of 2002. Favorite may not be exactly the right word for the interview we're about to hear with Gene Simmons of the band Kiss. But this interview certainly got more attention than anything we have ever broadcast on the show. It landed Simmons on Rolling Stone's list of the 10 biggest disappointments of the year. This interview also led Entertainment Weekly to name Simmons Crackpot of the Year. A live version of Kiss's 1975 hit Rock and Roll All Night. Kiss has sold plenty of gold records, but the group is as famous for its look as its music. They paint their faces in bold black and white patterns that seem inspired by comic book superheroes and villains. The band's wardrobe has included giant thigh-high platform boots, breastplates, heavy chains, and cod pieces. Simmons' specialty is breathing fire, throwing up blood, and wagging his long tongue. The band has been the subject of comic books and movies and has had all kinds of merchandising tie-ins. Gene Simmons is a stage name. He was born in Israel in 1949, the son of a Holocaust survivor. When he was 10, he moved with his mother to Queens, New York. There he dropped his Hebrew name and became Gene Klein. Our interview was first broadcast last February after the publication of Simmons' memoir, Kiss and Makeup, which is now out in paperback. Gene Simmons, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's start with the makeup. Did you like being covered up on stage? Did it make you feel any less vulnerable or any less like Gene Simmons or your other names, Gene Klein or Chaim Weitz, which was your birth name?
Close, but no guitars. It's Chaim Witz.
Oh, thanks. Okay.
You said it. The name came out through Gentile mouth, so it didn't quite have the flavor. It came out bland.
Well, it's not a Gentile mouth.
Ooh. Maybe it's a discussion we can have.
Yeah, okay.
But let's not start something we're not going to finish.
Right.
But in terms of the, what was the question about makeup?
Oh, did you like being covered up by makeup, and did it make you feel less vulnerable or, you know, less like Gene Simmons, Gene Klein, or your birth name?
I don't feel covered up any more or less than any girl feels covered up when she wears makeup. The makeup is simply an extension of a personality, and colors, clothing, makeup all express something. And getting up on stage was a chance to sort of live out the, sort of a scream therapy meets a rock and roll band version. I wanted to put together the band I never saw on stage. I wanted to be in a band that gave bang for the buck. I wanted to be in a band that didn't look like a bunch of guys who, you know, should be in a library studying for their finals. You know, I wanted stars up on stage. And regular people just didn't look big enough. So we wore 8-inch platform heels, put on more makeup and higher heels than your mother, and made more money than your banker. See, it all kind of works out.
Did you pattern your makeup on comic book heroes?
My makeup came as a result of a lot of things, all things Americana. Godzilla, horror movies, science fiction, Black Bolt, which was an Inhumans Marvel comic book, and science fiction, certainly. So it's comic books, all things sort of American pop culture. The rest of the guys in the band had different notions. Paul put on the red lips and the star over his eye as a kind of a exaggeration of what he thought a rock star was, because he always wanted to be a rock star. I was never interested in being a rock star. I always wanted to be Boris Karloff. And Ace, who's the spaceman in the group, you know, has delusions of grandeur, and perhaps gravity doesn't quite affect him in the same way, which is to say that he doesn't have good equilibrium, which is a big word, come to think of it, just like gymnasium. This is NPR. That's why we're using big words.
How would you describe the pattern on your face?
A banker's pattern. When you look at it, it says, boy, that guy's got a lot of money. You know why I'm pulling your leg? Because I can't touch it from where I am. This is a serious kind of...
Well, we'll get to that a little later.
Yeah, I'm not going to play
we'll
the
serious game. We'll get the tally a little
because
later.
This is all, after all, it means very little. I'm in a weird band. We've done very well. The American Dream is alive and well. And in terms of what it all means, it's sort of academic, really. It's about two guys from the intelligentsia, which is not the intelligence service, who sit around and sort of contemplate their navel. At the end of the day, it means nothing. At the end of the day, food tastes good. I like it or I don't like it. And Kiss, yeah, I like him or I don't like him. That's a conversation, and it's never-ending. But what you can't argue with is the American notion, which is of the people, for the people, by the people. They vote with money. You and I, we sit here and we just talk and toss the ball around. That doesn't mean a lot.
Are you trying to say to me that all that matters to you is money?
I will contend, and you try to disprove it, that the most important thing as we know it on this planet and this plane is, in fact, money. Want me to prove it?
Go ahead.
The first thing you need besides air, which so far is free, and by the way, if you went scuba diving, you're paying for air. The other thing besides that is food. It's what we need to survive. I don't know what other tool I would use besides money to buy it. Although, as a woman, of course, you have the ability to sell your body, then get the money, and then with that, get food. But ultimately, money is part of it.
You are weird.
Really? How do you get food?
Well, not by selling my body, but...
But that's a choice you have that I don't. But getting to the money part, money is the single most important thing on the planet, including the notion that love gives you everything. It's a load of hogwash, mm-hmm. because although I subscribe to the romantic notion of life...
Well, let's
I
get to the chase. How much money do you have?
Gee, a lot more than NPR.
Well, I know. You're very defensive on money, aren't you?
No, I'm not. I'm actually just trying to show you that there's a big world out there, and reading books is wonderful. I've certainly read, well, perhaps as many as you have, but there's a delusional kind of notion that runs rampant in...
Wait, could we just get something straight?
Of course.
I'm not here to prove that I'm smart, and
not
I'm not
you.
Here to prove that you're not smart or that you don't read books
not,
or can't make a lot of money.
This is not about you. You're being very defensive. Why are you doing that?
It's contagious.
Yeah.
Can we get back to your makeup? What do you use to paint your face, and do you ever break out from it?
No, it's actually oil-based. It's Stein's makeup is one of the brand names, but you can use lots of things. I don't think I've ever been asked that question, but no, my skin is more beautiful than yours. I would be quite more popular in jail if I so chose.
What do you do to take the makeup off? What do you use?
You use Pond's. You know, the same stuff women do, or you can use a Stein's concoction, which is, you know, sort of similar but more industrious. Industrial. Industrious means sort of ambitious. Industrial in strength.
Now, clothes that you've worn on stage include fishnet stockings, spike platform
That's
boots.
Actually untrue.
No?
No. Better research needed. Fire your research person. No fishnet stockings. Never. Not in this band.
Oh, I'm sure I saw you.
We catch fish with fishnets.
I was sure I saw you in them. But that's all right. I trust you. I trust you on that.
Don't ever do that. I'm a man.
No, let's get to the studded cod piece. Do you have a sense of humor about that? I mean, does that seem funny to you?
No, it holds in my manhood. Otherwise,
right.
It would be too much for you to take. You'd have to put the book down and confront life. The notion is that if you want to welcome me with open arms, I'm afraid you're also going to have to welcome me with open legs.
That's a really obnoxious thing to say.
No, it's not. Why should I say something behind your back that I can't tell you to your face?
Wait, Has it come to this? Is this the only way that you can talk to a woman, to do that shtick?
Let me ask you something. Why is it shtick when all women have ever wanted, ever since we've crawled out of caves, is why can't a man just tell me the truth and just speak to me plainly? So if I do that, you can't have it both ways.
So you really have no sense of humor about this, do you?
Oh, I'm laughing all the way. You know,
oh, to the bank, right?
Well, of course. Don't I sound like a happy guy?
Not really, to be honest with you.
I was going to suggest you get outside of the musty place where you can count the dust particles falling around you and get out in the world and see what everybody else is doing.
Having sex with you?
Well, if you chose, but you'd have to stand in line.
Well, that's the thing. We might as well get to this since you keep bringing it up. Yeah, you've had 4,000...
I didn't, actually. You did.
You write in your book you've had 4,600 sexual liaisons over the years.
You're supposed to say so far.
So far.
Right.
To you, this will be asking the obvious, but why have you wanted so many encounters?
I can only spell it in three letters, M-A-N. When a woman, and look, I'm not here to say that I'm a scientist or pretend or portend to be anything else. Those are semantics, of course, but then neither you nor I are anti-semantic. The notion is plain, and I read a book called Myth of Monogamy, which actually sort of approached the subject and verbalized it. And I finally understood what it was, because every woman suspects that the man she's laying next to is not necessarily going to be, well, faithful is the word. And privately, she tells her girlfriends, oh, God, all men are dogs. You're correct. And I'm here to tell you that in my deluded perspective, perhaps, it's biological. The first, quote, man and women, if man was predisposed to be monogamous, and we all lived in caves at that point, there were one or two alpha males and the rest were females. Either way, if we were monogamous within one or two generations, we would all be cross-eyed and retarded. Get it?
We're listening back to my interview with Gene Simmons, the bass player of Kiss. There's more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gene Simmons, the bass player of the band Kiss. Here's Kiss's 1977 recording, Love Gun. Let me ask this. You say you've had sex with about 4,600 people, women.
Women, yes.
You actually count? I mean, do you have like a book in which you, know, you I, you keep know, hash I never marks paid, for?
I never paid much attention to it because I've always lived my life the way my mother taught me to live it, which is that every day above ground is a good day. Don't look over your shoulder at society's rules or whether or not you please anybody else except you, because at the end of your life, right before they stick you underground, you can't go into the woulda, coulda, shoulda. You can't do that great Jewish joke. What's a great Jewish wine? I want to go to Palm Springs. Doesn't fly. You're responsible for your own happiness, and women have to get that notion over. Don't look to your guy. You have to figure out what makes you happy. And I did a long time ago. I'm an only child, and I had a lot of time to figure it out. And so what I figured out a long time ago was every day should be enjoyable. A, if you will, Epicurean hedonist Look it up in your Funkin' Wagnalls. And what it means is, life is the pursuit of pleasure, and I've done very well pursuing it. And so the band has been around 30 years. We're right behind the Beatles in the number of gold records by any groups in history. Somebody likes us. Women and their sisters and their moms seem to want to express their adoration and or fan worship, or perhaps they want to see if my oral appendage actually does have a spin and dry cycle and whether or not it has the ability to actually whip up a good froth. Ladies, I'm here to tell you it does. So for whatever reason they deem me worthy of their companionship, I was more than glad to oblige. And so almost 30 years ago, I started taking photos, Polaroids. And I still have them to this day. And so when the book was being written, Crown Publishers, who published my book, wanted to know, you know, you can't just say I did this and I did that. You've got to give specifics. So I sat down and started counting. One, two, and so on. And arrived at around 4,600 and change.
Mm-hmm. Are you interested in music, or is the goal of being in a rock band to have sex a lot?
I believe in my heart that anybody who gets up there and says what they're doing is art is on crack and is delusional, and that in point of fact, what they really, their modus operandi initially, perhaps it changed when they started to question their sexuality, but clearly initially it was to get laid and make lots of money. And anybody who tells you otherwise is lying to you. The reason we all wanted to pick up instruments initially, you know, publicly anyway, I will grant you there are those people who really love music and simply want to do it as a private pleasure. The jury is out. I have no comment. But as soon as you get up publicly and want other people to hear it, it seems odd that we really get off on the notion that the opposite sex, the fairer sex, that's you, like what we do. And perhaps if we do it really well, you'll think, gee, he's not only talented and bright, but he's kind of cute, too. That's what we're hoping for, against all odds. And in music, it's the great aphrodisiac that says that even though I'm short, fat, ugly, bald, and I'm hung like a second grader, if I'm in a rock band, I've got a better than average chance of bedding you down than if I was a dentist. I didn't make those rules. I come from Israel. I'm simply a student at your feet. This is what I've noticed.
Are you interested in music at all?
Don't you love this interview? Tell me the truth.
Well, I think it's kind of a drag because you're making speeches and you're being intentionally
right.
Obnoxious.
No, I'm not. I'm being a man.
That's what I mean. You're being intentionally obnoxious by defining everything that you're saying as being a man.
Well, I can't
talk. I know better. I know all men.
No, I always define it by the way that you're speaking. You're wrong. I always defined it as for me. I kept doing that over and over again. What bothers you is you're finally hearing a man tell the truth. Instead of, you're the only one I'll ever live with and you're the... He's lying. And I refuse to play that game. I refuse to stand up in front of a rabbi and my friends and the woman I love, who I will tell you I can love with all my heart, and promise that she's going to be the only one I will ever have until the day I die. That's a lie.
Do you like the movie Spinal Tap? And do you think that the Spinal Tap has any comment on
rock and roll?
Like
sure.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. Sure. I think it's all funny. I mean, when you really think about it, I'm not delusional enough to think that what I do is important to life as we know it on this planet. No, but neither is what you do. You know, the world can get along very well without us. Farmers are more important, teachers and firemen and so on, because if they're not around, it really affects us. Your job and my job, whether you wear less makeup and I wear more makeup, is to entertain people. And I'm here to tell you, I'm very entertaining. I don't know about you, but this is NPR.
What exactly is NPR in your mind?
I never knew. It always sounds like a sixth-grade school teacher. See, if I was in charge, give me the reins, I would get National Public Radio. People start snoring. I'm not questioning the content. You should have bright people on. Maybe you should never have me on again if you don't think I'm bright. Clearly, it should be a wonderful place for people who read and are bright to have a conversation, a discourse perhaps, without hearing whatever it is you hate about the outside world. Fine. How about some style? Give me a little spice instead of this bland. You ever see the Saturday Night Live version? It's pretty spot on.
Have you listened to it enough to know if it's spot on?
Sure. I was in Los Angeles and did a quick one. P.J. O'Rourke, who's great, who wrote for Rolling Stone, was on with myself and one other gentleman, I don't remember, and the DJ guy gets on, "Good afternoon, Gene." Going, "What's the matter? Why are you talking like that? What do you mean?" Going, "You know what? Let PJ talk. PJ the DJ. You need, as a listener, I would beg you guys to get something else on the air. Something with style. I change the call letters, NPR. I change it. Give it some oomph, Lexus, Locus, something. See?"
Gene Simmons is the bass player of Kiss. Our interview was first broadcast last February. We'll hear more of it in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Wayne Kramer looks back on the 1960s and his work with the radical band the MC5, and we continue our question, answer, and insult session with Gene Simmons of Kiss.
Overdose.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our infamous interview with Gene Simmons, the bass player of Kiss, the band he co-founded in the 70s. The band became famous for its shows in which the musicians painted their faces in black and white patterns. On stage, Simmons breathes fire, spits blood, and wags his long tongue. Simmons grew up in Israel and moved to Queens, New York when he was 10. Our interview was first broadcast last February. We're featuring it as part of our Encore Week. What was the age of your audience when Kiss started to perform?
That's a good question, because in 1972 or 73, when we first started, it was late teens, and I'd say 18 to 20, 60 to 70% male. And then when Kiss became the number one band, you know, within a year and a half, we were playing Anaheim Stadium, and we had toys, games, comic books, everything you can imagine. The age really widened, and we had fans as young as 3 years old. And then through the 80s and stuff, the audience got older as we did less toys, less comic books, and so on. And now in the 90s, and of course through the 2000 era, we've got over 2,500 licenses. There's a Kiss Broadway play on the way with Rob Roth, who directed Beauty and the Beast, a Kiss cartoon show with the people who do Transformers and Beast Wars. Superman meets Kiss. That's going to be the kickoff of the new Superman, rather the new Kiss comic book series. So we're going everywhere. I can be on the cover of Playboy magazine, and I can sell comic books and bubblegum to younger fans, and it's all good. And instead of being in a rock and roll band, who the hell wants to do that? I don't. I want to be in a rock and roll brand. I want to be Disney without the overhead. And I'm on the way.
Let's talk about your background. You were born in Israel several years after the war ended. Your mother, during the war, was in a Nazi concentration camp. Do you have any memories of life in Israel?
I do. The German Nazi concentration camps during World War II, which the entire German population, or enough of it that you can say the German population, bought into hook, line, and sinker, was a result of my mother's and millions of other people's misery. And Israel was a strange place anyway. It was certainly not an easy place to go to. But 6 months after the, quote, independence of Israel, as recognized by the UN and who knows who else, I popped out. So where I was born was really an accident, just like everybody else. And growing up in Israel was sort of being in a box where you're not aware that the outside world exists. I certainly never saw a television set. I didn't know about Kleenex or supermarkets or anything. All I knew was you heard stories in school about David and Goliath and, you know, all these wonderful, great superheroic stories, and the sea is splitting open and wide, and our people go through it, and then it crashes again on the Egyptians, and, you know, all these great stories. But and then slowly people started to tell me, no, this is the place that happened. You're actually living in it. So it was tough to take in. So at 8 and a half years of age, when I came over to America with my mother, it was like being thrown into another dimension. I had never heard of Santa Claus or Christ or Christmas, never knew anything about Christians or that there were other kinds of people. And from then on, I became a sponge. I wanted to just take it all in. It was just way beyond anything I could ever imagine. And television, the great television, and rock and roll and horror movies and science fiction and comic books were my education. And I thank God that those were what I learned instead of having to read Jane Eyre at an early age, because it wasn't anything I could relate to.
I know you went to a yeshiva as a boy. Were you from an Orthodox family?
No, nobody in the family was Orthodox, but when I came to America, my mother, being a single mother, had to go out and work from 6 in the morning till 7 at night, so she put me in a yeshiva, which is a Jewish theological seminary. In other words, you're studying to be somebody, and I was studying to be a rabbi. And they fed me and clothed me, and, you know, you sort of take care of your child. That way you don't have to worry that your child is on the street. And so while I was there, I saw one world, the closed world, and when I turned on television, people were flying through the air, and they had capes, and there were cartoons, and, you know, just amazing things, and I wanted to go there. I thought that was a lot cooler than yarmulkes.
What's your mother's reaction to KISS?
Well, it's interesting. Good question. My mother is probably the wisest person I've ever known. She's not schooled. She's not well-read. And yet she has a philosophy about life that makes well-read people seem like morons. She doesn't talk a lot, uses very few words to express herself, unlike myself, who likes the sound of his own voice. So here's a woman who'd been through the German Nazi concentration camps of World War II and still thought that there was goodness in humanity and thought about the fact that the glass was half full instead of half empty. And when asked about, well, what about your son? You know, he's in this weird rock band. He dresses weird and, you know, apparently has lots of liaisons and girls and stuff. What do you think about that? She goes, well, as long as he doesn't use drugs and alcohol and doesn't hurt anybody, I don't care about the rest. You know what? She's right.
Well, you said that you don't use drugs, and you've never had a drink of alcohol.
That's not true. I've never been drunk.
You've never been drunk. That's right, yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I literally, you know, at parties when somebody says toast, I try to take a sip, but without saying it for effect, it's true, when as soon as I smell alcohol, I start to gag. I may be blessed with some kind of chemical reaction against it, but I won't go near the most beautiful woman who's got my name written all over her. If she opens her mouth and smells like a truck driver who just drank Bud, I'm out of there, gone. It always struck me bizarre that women are willing to paint their mouths beautifully with lipstick and yet smoke and drink and make their breath smell like a garbage heap. So I can't do that. I can't be around people who numb their senses. Everybody's allowed, as far as I'm concerned, to take their own life or numb themselves to oblivion. I could care less. I have no sympathy for anybody who has the lives in America, especially, and who decides, you know what, I'm going to numb myself. Drugs, alcohol, cigarettes. So I'm happy to be alive every single day, and I want my senses working 24 hours a day. And if you were in my room and we were going to have a liaison and you were high, you'd be out on your butt before you could spell your last name. Because if you don't want to experience me with all the senses God gave you, you don't deserve to be with me.
You said you don't have sympathy for that guy on the roof who keeps saying I'm going to jump. My impression is you don't have much sympathy for anyone. You're so into yourself. You're just so deep into yourself.
I think everybody should be. If it sounds like admiration coming out of you, I accept it. I think life is too short to have anything but delusional notions about yourself, which is you should really like yourself more than you deserve to, because the alternative isn't very good. You should really think you are better looking than you are, because the alternative is sort of, you know, some bad notions. And so I'm aware, as a sane person, that I'm not the best looking guy in the world. I'm aware of it. But when I go into a party, I will walk out with your girlfriend.
Just one more question before we wrap up.
I
would like to think that the personality you've presented on our show today is a persona that you've affected as a member of KISS, something that you do on stage and before the microphone, but that mm-hmm. you're not nearly as obnoxious in the privacy of your own home or when you're having dinner with friends.
Fair enough. And I'd like to think that the boring lady who's talking to me now is a lot sexier and more interesting than the one who's doing NPR, you know, studious and reserved. And I bet you're a lot of fun at a party.
Well, we'll leave it at that. Gene Simmons,
sure.
Thanks so much.
I look forward to our meeting.
Bye-bye. Gene Simmons of the band KISS. Our interview was first broadcast last February. It generated more email and press response than any interview in the history of our show. Coming up as our Encore Week continues, Wayne Kramer talks about co-founding the band the MC5, which combined music and revolution in the 60s. This is Fresh Air. In the late 60s, when a lot of rock bands saw themselves as being in the vanguard of a cultural or political revolution, the Detroit-based band, the MC5, was one of the most radical of them all. The music was loud and often dissonant, some lyrics had expletives you couldn't play on the radio, and the band's politics were on the far left. In their early days, they were managed by John Sinclair, the head of the White Panther Party, who used to preach revolution at the MC5's concerts. They played at many demonstrations, including the protest at the Chicago Democratic Convention. The band was a critical success and a popular one with a top 30 album. The MC5 broke up in 1972. Now the band is seen as a forerunner of punk rock and an early expression of heavy metal. Guitarist, singer, and songwriter Wayne Kramer was a founding member of the MC5. Now he plays what he describes as songs about grown-up people doing grown-up things. This year he had an album called Adult World. Let's start with the track Talking Out of School.
Do I need a shower? Or do I need a shave? Do I need an inside tip? Is there any money that I can save? Do I need to mind my business? Or stick my feet in yours? When it's clear that one man's ceiling is another's floor. You see the heights of my extravagance, the rooms of the upper house, and it illustrates my true currency with their man of mouth. And I'll assassinate your character, cause I live by my own rules, and I'll write it off as a voice of faith. So talk, 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 talking out of school. Talk, 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 talking out of school. Talk, 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 talking out of school.
Let's go back to the beginning, more or less, of your story. You grew up in Detroit. Did your father work in the audio industry?
In a satellite sense. You know, he was an electrician and later was in the building trades. And then I had a stepfather later on who also worked in the, he actually worked in an oil refinery there in Detroit.
Did you figure that when you grew up, your job would somehow be connected to the auto industry?
Well, that was my fear. You know, that's the birthright if you're born in the industrial Midwest, you know, that you're gonna end up a shop rat.
How was the MC5 first created? And let's place it. It was, what, 1968, 67?
Well, that's when we kind of broke out of a regional popularity onto the national consciousness. But we really started about 64, 65. In a neighborhood kind of way, you know. I looked around for guys in the neighborhood that wanted to be in a band, and collected a bunch of ne'er-do-wells, just like me. We kind of coagulated as the MC5 at a point. Me, Rob Tyner, Fred Smith, Michael Davis, and Dennis Thompson, and really, you know, we really worked hard on what we were trying to do. We really worked hard on trying to be the best band we could possibly be, you know, be better than everybody else. Because for us, we looked at it as a way out of the factory, as an alternative to the lifestyle that we were guaranteed to have to fulfill.
Well, the MC5 became, you know, a self-styled revolutionary group. What politicized you? What got you thinking more about revolution than Chuck Berry?
Well, Chuck Berry was revolutionary. But, you know, it was the day we were very much a part of the time we lived in. We just were frustrated with the slow pace of change. We were anxious about the future. And we felt like we had to take action. And the action we took was in endorsing our idols, which were the Black Panther Party and Malcolm X, and our, you know, our spiritual leaders, which we viewed as John Coltrane and, you know, and Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Archie Shepp. And we tried to bring all these ideas together in a message that our band could represent, self-efficacy, that we could present the idea that, you know, you didn't have to go along with the program, that there was a better way that we could do things.
The band hooked up with John Sinclair, who was the head of the White Panther Party. What was the philosophy of the party?
Well, Bobby Seale and Huey Newton put out the call for there to be a group in the white community, in the hippie community, to take up parallel work with the Black Panther Party. And we were ready. I mean, we just said, yeah, that's us, you know. And it was romantic and it was dangerous. But I don't want you to think that, you know, that we were sitting in a warehouse on the west side of Detroit desperately cleaning our shotguns waiting for the revolution. I mean, we sat around a table and smoked tons of marijuana and laughed our asses off at what was going on. And this all just seemed to make perfect sense to us, you know.
Let me read part of the 10-point program of the White Panther Party.
Mm-hmm.
We want justice. We want a free world economy. We want a clean planet. We want a free educational system. We want to free all structures from corporate rule. We want free access to all information, media, and technology. We want the freedom of all people who are being held against their will in the conscripted armies of the oppressor throughout the world. We want the freedom of all political prisoners of war. We want a free planet. We want free land, free food, free shelter, free clothing, free music, free culture, free media, free technology, free education, free healthcare, free bodies, free people, free time and space, everything free. Bring back memories?
Love it. Boy, that sounds great.
did you charge for concerts or were they always free?
Oh, we charged as much as we could. Unfortunately, many times they were free.
Speaking of free, I mean, I remember there were a lot of rallies in the 1960s. Free John Sinclair, who mm-hmm. was affiliated with the MC5 and was mm-hmm. arrested, sentenced to 10 years for carrying 2 cigarettes. So what was the relationship of...
To marijuana cigarettes.
I'm sorry, 2 joints, yeah.
Right.
What was the relationship of John Sinclair to the MC5?
Well, John was officially our manager, but he was really... See, we had tried to work with, like, music business-type managers before, and it never worked because we were really insane. We were unmanageable. And John was the first guy we met that actually the band respected. And John admitted that, you know, he didn't know what he was doing either, that, you know, he had just learned from the Grateful Dead. They didn't know what they were doing, and they said, yeah, we've got these corporations to give us money, these record companies, and you could do it too. So we said, hell yes, let's try. What would you be if you didn't try?
On one of the MC5 recordings, Ramblin' Rose, there's a live introduction by Jesse Crawford, who is the White Panther Minister of Information.
Mm-hmm.
Was this a kind of standard thing in concerts that one of the White Panthers would come up and give their rap before a performance?
Well, we were all ministers of something or another. We ministers of culture in the streets, ministers of defense, ministers of, I hope it comes across that this stuff was done with a lot of humor. You know, we really weren't, you know, it didn't get heavy till much later. It was really done with a lot of fun in the early days. But that was J.C. Crawford's role. He was our MC. You know, our master of ceremonies. And we tried to build this show based on our heroes, and one of them was James Brown. And James Brown has an MC that would come out and say, you know, and now the hardest working man in show business here to sing such hits as Try Me, da-da, I'll Go Crazy, da-da. So we took that spirit of what he was doing, and JC came up with his own text on it. Because we want to make this a show. We wanted to entertain people and take them someplace they hadn't been before. Because the world, as far as we could see, I mean, there were some awful bands back in those days. You know, the California bands were terrible. You know, they could barely play. And they would come into Detroit, you know, with these huge reputations. And we'd say, God, you guys, man, kick out the jams or get off the stage, you know. Because we were focused on this idea of high energy. We wanted to have energy in our performance because that was the thing that felt the best. And when I listen to music, if I listen to black gospel music, there's a visceral commitment. There's a visceral energy to it. There's a spirit to it that touches me. The music of James Brown, the music of Chuck Berry, and the free jazz music. You know, I even heard it in, you know, the music of The Who or some early Rolling Stones tracks. It had that energy. So that was the thing we focused on. So having the MC was part of that to create this entire spectacular event.
So instead of having the James Brown MC talking about his hits, you had J.C. Crawford saying, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem.
Exactly.
Let's hear the introduction to Ramblin' Rose and hear some of Ramblin' Rose as well. You're singing lead on this.
That's me, yeah.
Brothers and sisters, the time has come for each and every one of you to decide whether you are going to be the problem or whether you are going to be the solution.
That's right.
You must choose, brothers. You must choose. It takes 5 seconds. 5 seconds of decision. 5 seconds to realize your purpose here on the planet. It takes 5 seconds to realize that it's time to move. It's time to get down with it. Brothers, it's time to testify, and I want to know, are you ready to testify? Are you ready? I give you a testimonial. The MC Fire!
MC5's recording Ramblin' Rose, the lead vocal on that sung by my guest, Wayne Kramer, who has a new CD called Adult World. What kind of crowd reactions would you get? What were the best reactions? What were the most extreme reactions?
Well, probably the best reactions we got were in the Detroit area, you know, because we played there regularly for years, and we had a regular job at the Grandy Ballroom, and we created that audience in Detroit and groomed them to be the best rock and roll audience in the world. And, you know, we were able to transmit that to Chicago, to Cleveland, to New York. And ultimately, we carried our message across the sea to England. But it never really translated on the West Coast. The hippies just didn't connect with the MC5. You know, we had too much macho energy. Our clothes were too shiny. Our amps were too big. And we did too much leaping, spinning, screaming, hollering, feedback. And, you know, California was all about, you know, wear some flowers in your hair. And we were just out of sync with the West Coast.
My guest is Wayne Kramer, co-founder of the MC5. This year he had a solo CD called Adult World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Wayne Kramer. He co-founded the band The MC5, which combined music and revolution in the 60s. This year he had a solo album called Adult World. It was very difficult for you when the MC5 broke up, and you went through a kind of long period of addiction to heroin, alcohol. You spent some time in prison in, I think it was the mid-70s?
Mm-hmm. It's when I first started listening to All Things Considered.
Oh, that's what they all say in prison.
A lot of people in prison listen to All Things Considered. It's a great
they really?
Show. Absolutely.
That's really funny. Good. So you were in prison for what, selling drugs
to a federal
an undercover agent?
Yeah.
What was their cover?
that they were New York mafioso drug couriers. They looked the part, and they talked the part, and they walked the part. And see, you know, when the band broke up, I really lost my connection to any spiritual principles, any principles at all, you know. And I was really kind of adrift there in a real negative time and a place. And doing wrong is a way of getting attention, too. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. And there's a whole hierarchy in the criminal underworld of, you know, being a ghetto star, you know, being a hustler, being an earner, being, you know, somebody that gets paid, someone that gets over. This is the kind of terminology that, you know, that was in my speech a lot. This is the way I thought a lot. And that all culminated with this huge narcotics conspiracy that I was involved in.
How hard is it for you now to stay straight?
Well, hard. You know, it's not that it's hard, because I know today that I don't have a drug and an alcohol problem. I have a living problem. And
What do you mean?
Well, see, drugs and alcohol make it possible for me to live in a world that I can't live in, you know, because I've got so many resentments, you know, because I'm angry about the MC5, because I'm angry that, you know, my peers are all wealthy and I'm not. You know, I'm angry because I didn't get the girl I wanted. I'm angry, I have resentments. I have all this baggage that I carry with me, and it makes the world a world I can't live in. So fortunately, I've been able to find a way to live, where, drinking isn't necessary and getting high isn't necessary, and that I can have a good life, a full life, and be grateful for every day that I have in this life, you know.
Our interview with Wayne Kramer was first broadcast last August after the release of his CD, Adult World. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Schirach. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Flying Betty Cleveland came in off the lake. Must have run in on the winter wind when no one was.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Niagara Falls All Over Again by Elizabeth McCracken, author of A Giant's House, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Encore Week continues with some of our favorite in-studio performances from 2002. We'll hear Rebecca Kilgore and Dave Frischberg perform songs by Rodgers and Hart, and Richard Thompson will play originals and covers. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.